Part 1. Exterior, Hiroshima, Japan, 1945, day. A breeze of black smoke rises from below to fill a colorless sky in front of us. A distant military airplane hums across, coinciding with the action on the ground. The sound of slow-moving vehicles, shovels piercing the earth, metal that bends and clamors. On the ground, Japanese civilians lay forward on their knees amongst the scorched earth and building sediments, bowed in despair. An armored bulldozer is maneuvering to claw up rubble, creating a huge rubble mound. Around this mound, 6 United States soldiers dig up heaps of the aftermath to help build it up, causing ash to spray to air around them. Among these soldiers is a young man, no older than 20. His weathered green uniform reads USMC, United States Marine Corps. He shovels alongside the others, yet seems to be somewhere else, even worse than here. He digs and dumps like a machine. The young man then stops, shovel in the earth. He turns up to watch the fly-sized plane hum away, seeming to know its destination, before his attention turns to the giant, scorched chess piece around him, the nearby empty souls. The Genbaku Dome, the only thing erect in the distance, alongside the surrounding smoke. The young man now focuses beyond this, to the faraway mountainous hills. He zones out. The peak of the rubble mound then collapses behind him, causing the other soldiers to jilt back from it. The young man turns back to the mound, to what the peak now reveals. His face displays both horror and uncertainty in what he sees as the sound of wind gusts through him. What you have just read is an excerpt from an old war movie script, written and based on his experience during the Pacific War by James Howard Schrader, my grandfather. In 1943, the fourth year of the Second World War, James Schrader was drifting to the 23rd Regiment of the 4th Marine Division, where he eventually experienced combat on the Pacific Islands of Kwajalein, Saipan, and Iwo Jima. After the end of the Pacific Theater in 1945, James would spend the next 7 years in Japan, serving under U.S. occupation. By 1952, and having been in the military for nearly 10 years, James finally left Japan and came home. For the next few years of his life, James would live and work in Los Angeles as a struggling screenwriter in Hollywood. By 1992, the year of his death, James left behind an ex-wife, an estranged son, and 3 grandchildren he never met. Before my grandfather's demise, he would leave a final letter among his possessions, a letter written and addressed to my father, his son. Although my father already knew about his experience during the Pacific War, along with the horrors he witnessed, he knew little to nothing about my grandfather's time serving during the occupation of Japan. That was until he found my grandfather's letter. Despite the very real and human horrors my grandfather saw in the Pacific, what he would then experience on Japanese soil, supposedly during a time of peace, was not only horror, but a horror of the paranormal. What you are about to read, should you choose to, is this very same letter. A letter that is less the final words of a dying old man, but a final confession. To my son, Jonathan. I know it has been some years now since we last spoke, and I know any attempt by me to communicate with you will be ignored, and so that's why I'm writing this letter for you to find upon my death. I'm not writing this to apologize for the terrible father I was to you, nor for the indecent husband your mother had to bear. I'm writing this to tell you a story I have never told another soul. You are my son, and you may remember me for the monster I became, but you will never know me for the decent man I was, nor what it was that made that man the monster you know now. You may think it was the war, that the death and destruction I witnessed at the hand of the enemy, and even our own, is what left me the shell of a man who raised you. And that is true. Very little of me had survived these brutal few years of fighting, but if you must know, it wasn't the war with the Japanese that made me the man I became. On the contrary, it was what came after. I've never told you this part of my life, Jonathan, nor did I ever think I would. I have seen the worst of humanity. I have seen the evil and horror we partake upon those who are not alike ourselves. And I have seen what it creates, what it feeds and gives power to, I have told you every horror story I know from that war, but I've never told you this. Back in 52, I was serving my 7th year during the occupation of the Japanese islands. I had known 7 years without war, but no peace. Our authority over the Japanese people was shortly coming to a close, and so we had to make sure our influence in this country would carry on long after we were gone. You have to understand, son, the world back then was still a very fragile place. The war may have been over, but old enemies were quickly replaced by new ones. The threat of communism was very real, and nowhere was it more real than East and Southeast Asia. The commies in China had spread their influence south to Korea and Indochina, or what you would come to know as Vietnam. Before we left Japan to once again govern themselves, we needed to make sure the communist threat would not find its way here. For 7 years after Hiroshima, we told the Japanese how they should live, what they could read or not read, what they could and couldn't listen to, what they could and couldn't watch. I've always been a lover of movies. You know that. Whereas we Americans had our cowboys and Indians, the Japanese had their jidaideki, period movies portraying feudalist Japan. Once Japan came under our occupation, MacArthur put a permanent ban on jidaideki movies from being made. It was supposed to be a way of stripping the Japanese of their identity and history. But by 52, and with our eventual departure on the horizon, the ban of Japanese period films had finally been lifted. Although Japanese filmmakers could once again make movies about their nation's history, we now feared what messages they may put in them. If they wanted to put a message of Japanese nationalism, that was of no such concern. But it was the message of socialism that my superiors truly feared the most. In order to counter this fear, American operatives were to keep a close eye on the production of these pictures. I was among these operatives. My mission, assigned to me by Far East Command themselves, was to oversee the production of a picture being filmed in the Izu Peninsula, roughly 90 miles southwest of Tokyo base. My orders were to report any signs of socialist or anti-American allegories present in the picture's production, however minimal. The picture assigned to me was called Ronin no Tani, or in English, Valley of the Ronin. The plot was pretty straightforward. A small village during the Tokugawa period comes under constant attacks by bandits and criminals, whereby the villagers must turn to a masterless samurai to train them in the art of combat. The director of the picture was a man called Takumi Asagawa, or as everyone called him, Ase-san. I just simply called him Mr. Asagawa. Mr. Asagawa was one of the most prominent directors in Japan, and his previous film received much praise from several international film festivals. Although Mr. Asagawa knew all too well why I was present during the production of his movie, the man seemed to take a very keen liking to me. I think what it came down to was that we both had a shared love for wild westerns. He even claimed the script to Valley of the Ronin was his own reimagining of the western trope. After arriving in the peninsula, I was then transported to the Takata district, where lied a beautiful, lush, green valley. This is where the majority of the movie was being filmed. Each side of the valley was enclosed by a forested, very steep, mountainous slope, where the middle of the valley was the movie set. A 16th century Tokugawa village of straw-roofed huts and mud paths had been constructed, along with several rice paddies and a rickety wooden bridge over a stream. The first time I saw it, I'll never forget. It genuinely felt to me as though I had been transported back through history to a time of simple and honest living. Most of the actors playing the role of villagers wore ragged pieces of cloth, stray hats, and nothing on their feet. The man playing the Ronin, I forget the actor's name, wore a long, dirty kimono where his sword hung out the side. Among the actors and extras in the authentic 16th century clothing were the rest of the film crew. Of course, there was Mr. Asagawa, but then there was the assistant director, the sound and cameraman, etc. I actually became good friends with the third assistant director on the picture, a young man called Benjiro, but I called him Ben for short. You know, son, the first time I ever saw Godzilla was with him inside a Tokyo movie theater. As idyllic as I appear to be making this valley and the production sound, I'm afraid this is where it must end. Because what follows for the next year of this picture's production was nothing short of horror. The movie began filming in the summer of 52, and the heat that year was nothing less than scalding. After only 2 weeks of filming, the thatched roofs of the village huts caught fire midday, and before long, the entire set had become ablaze. We were able to put out the fire, but by the time we did, the entire set, built painstakingly from scratch, had been burnt to ash. What used to be a 16th century village, lying peacefully between the slopes of the valley, was now the charcoaled remnants of foundations. The scene of this, for me, was to say the least, haunting. I've already told you about my time in Hiroshima, haven't I, son? Well, once the bomb was dropped, myself and other Marines were there at ground level. Our job was to help clear up the mess and provide aid to civilians, and let me tell you, the scenes I witnessed there had stayed with me my entire life. The black, charcoal rubble of the buildings, the bodies we pulled out from under them, stiff and burnt to a crisp. Women and children, babies, all the horrors I witnessed in those days in what used to be a city were swiftly brought back by the burning of this village. But it wasn't just the burnt thatch roof huts. It wasn't just the smell of smoke and charcoal that burns your eyes and down your throat. It was the bodies there, too. Once we put the fire out, two men from the film crew were later reported to be missing. After searching all over the valley, we eventually found them. Or should I say, we found the bodies. One we had pulled out from beneath the burnt stacks of rubble. But the other one was different. We found him inside one of the burnt huts that was somehow still standing. He was sat down in there, right there in the middle of the room. But what was so horrifically strange about this was, like the bodies I saw at Hiroshima, this man sat cross-legged and upright like the Buddha himself, was completely black and burnt to a crisp. The way this man's body was positioned, it was as though he had no idea he was in the middle of a burning room. Did you know, son, Godzilla was an allegory for the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I did. I knew it as soon as I saw it. A giant radioactive monster laying waste to the streets of Tokyo. When I walked out of that movie theater and Ben followed me, I throttled him, just because he said we should see the movie. I wish I could say the fire was the only incident which happened during the production of Valley of the Ronin, that those crewmen were the only casualties we had, but I would be lying to you, son, and I would be lying to myself. Weeks later, after the village was reconstructed and filming once again began, it didn't take long for more strange things to keep happening. Like the two crewmen we found after the fire, more people on set started disappearing. Members of the crew, some extras, and even a handful of actors. We found some of them in the forest upon the mountain slopes. The first of which was a woman wearing the ragged clothes of a villager. Except she hadn't gotten lost. If she had done so, all she needed to do was wander down the slope. No, she had just gone mad. Delirious. When we found her, she was digging up dirt from the ground with her bare hands, her fingernails left bloody and out of place. Once she saw us approach, she turned up her head and just started laughing, as though she was playing a practical joke. But then, she started clawing up the loose pieces of earth and stuffing them into her mouth, chewing down on it. The woman had somehow lost her damned mind. We found some more of the crew like that in the forest, some stark naked and crazy, some just the latter. But the ones we didn't find like that were a whole lot worse. The way we found them, they may have gone crazy, but we couldn't know entirely for sure. We found them lying face down on the sloping ground, every single one of them. A leg or an arm contorted in the air, in some cases, both. We found them that way because they had jumped from an incredible height. For whatever reason, these members of the crew had climbed up a tree to as high as they could, and then they jumped. The branches seemed to do little to break their fall. I'm sure you remember what I told you about Saipan in 44. God, how could anybody forget? You remember the woman who threw their infants off the northern cliffs, don't you? If the Japanese hadn't lied about what we'd do to them once we took the island, a whole lot of innocent lives could have been spared. The way one of these ladies looked at me, and once she realized we meant her nor her baby any harm, I swear to God, it was the same look in her eye the woman we found in the forest had, where there was once sanity and reason. Only madness was left. Part 2. For a while, things on set, thankfully, went back to normal. Around a month or so later into production, the heat had finally began to cool off. Instead, however, we had days on end of continual rain. In fact, the rain was so bad for the next couple of months, the stream around the village had burst, causing the mud pathways to flood. If that wasn't bad enough, the heavy rain and strong winds had destroyed half of the thatch roof huts, causing production to shut down for a good month. The only upside during this time was that nobody else had died. After what happened with the fire and the many tragedies in the forest, I half expected to find some members of the crew drowned face down somewhere. I went back to Tokyo the next month, and they once again had to rebuild the whole set. I was surprised they didn't just wrap things up then and there. After all, news of the deaths had already gotten out in the press, and having to rebuild the whole village again had cost the studio a fortune. If I hadn't learnt it in the Pacific, I certainly did then. The Japanese, as a people, really don't know when to quit. When I got back to the district, I was put up in the same little inn I stayed the last time. After a few weeks of filming, everything seemed to be going good and irregularly smooth. There were no more deaths to report of, no more destruction of the set, or barely even a hiccup. All of that was until we reached the 8th month of shooting. On a very cold winter morning, maybe sometime in January or February, I forgot which it was, I woke up to something very cold and wet coming down on me from above. I must have drank too much sake that night, because when I wake up, I find that I'm no longer warm inside my small inn room, and instead, the freezing temperatures of the outdoors had completely numbed my hands and bare feet. Once I get my bearings, I find that I'm inside a forest, but not just any forest. It was the same forest on the side of the mountain slope, the one where we found the bodies. Although I hadn't the damnedest idea how I'd gotten all the way up here, the strange thing about it was, I somehow reeked of gasoline, as though it was on my hands and clothing. Despite the strangeness of waking up on the mountain slope, once I got warm and back inside, I didn't think anything more of it. After all, I did drink a whole lot of sake that night, and it was rather common for me to wake in some strange place after a night of drinking, as you know all too well, son. In the evening that same day, we were scheduled to shoot a scene towards the end of the picture's second act. The scene in question was centered around a large barn in the village, where a bandit was holding a young child hostage inside, and the villagers had to find some way of getting the child back unharmed. However, after a couple of takes, the actor playing the bandit rushed out with the child in his arms and just started shouting, "Kachita! Kachita!" My Japanese was still rusty, even after all those years, but I knew Kachida meant there was a fire somewhere. Well, not long after the actor comes out of hiding, a few members of crew notice smoke coming from the roof, and only mere seconds later, the entire structure quickly becomes ablaze in no time at all. Everyone rushed to the stream with buckets to help put out the fire, but by the time we do, the barn was already a lost cause. The second assistant director suddenly starts shouting, "Benjiro, Benjiro!" I looked over, and I see my friend Ben is walking towards the barn entrance, appearing to enter the infernal structure. I shout over to him to get out of there, but he either doesn't listen or doesn't hear. Before I can do anything, Ben disappears inside, the darkness and smoke enclosing behind him. Although I'm afraid to enter the burning barn, I know I have to save my friend. Stepping inside the dark interior, I can barely see a thing, despite the many flames around me. Wandering through the darkness, my lungs already fill up on smoke, causing me to not only look for my friend, but any pockets of oxygen. After wandering blindly around, already burning myself on my arms and legs, I eventually find Ben. For some reason, He was sat down directly in the middle of the room, and although I had a hard time seeing, I noticed his legs weren't knelt down like how most Japanese sit, but crossed-legged like the image of the Buddha himself. Ben's clothes had already caught fire, and so I tried shouting at him to get up and come with me, but he had no reaction, as though he didn't even know I was there. The son of a bitch didn't even blink. Unresponsive, I then heave Ben to his feet and haul him into the direction of the entrance. My clothes had already caught fire by now, and I could feel the pain of the flames burning my flesh. Seeing the light of the entrance, I then haul our asses out of there, whereby the crew throw buckets of cold stream water on top of us. Although Ben and I thankfully survived the endeavor, we were in pretty bad shape. I had burn marks all over my arms and legs, as well as my abdomen. But Ben was a lot worse. His entire body had practically caught fire, burning away most of his clothes and almost all his hair. We were both then taken to hospital afterwards, and our wounds tended to. After a few days to recover from my injuries, I was then discharged. But before I left, I went to see how Ben was doing. Entering his room, I saw he was covered almost head to foot in bandages. Although I could see his face, his skin was red and swollen, making him unrecognizable to me. Once Ben had finally woke up, I asked him what the hell he was doing walking to the burning barn. Unlike my Japanese, Ben's English was pretty good. But even so, my question seems to confuse him. According to Ben, he had no memory of what happened that day, only waking up in a hospital room in excruciating pain. I told Ben what had happened, and he thanked me for saving his life, but then he told me something I wasn't expecting. Although Ben was my friend, I knew very little about his life. I didn't know where he was from, or even if the man had a family of his own. That day, in his hospital room, Ben told me he was born and raised in Hiroshima, of all places, and that during the war, he was studying in Tokyo, which is how he survived the bomb. His family, however, and basically everyone else he knew back home, had perished. The neighbors on his street, the friends he made in his childhood, everybody. Ben said he lived with the guilt of this for many years and even wished he had been there with them. He would die in that hospital room 3 days later. Because of Ben's unfortunate death and the destruction caused by the barn fire, the studio put a permanent end to the picture's production, leaving the film unfinished, and with many lives taken in the process. Since the picture wouldn't be finished, I had no job to do, or anything left to report, so my supervisors had called me back to Tokyo base. Because of my severe injuries, I was eventually given an honorary and medical discharge, where only a short month later, for the first time in 8 years, I finally came back home to the States. As bad as the war in the Pacific was for me, son, as bad as it was in Hiroshima, what I experienced in that valley was something else entirely. Although I am all too acquainted with the evil of humanity, whatever evil lied inside the slopes of those mountains was beyond the evil of man. And whatever that evil was, and still may be, I truly believe it wanted my soul. It wanted to take my life through the horrors of my past. And I believe it wanted the same thing of Ben. The guilt he must have felt, it used it against him, of not dying with his family in hellish oblivion. Now you know, son. Now you know why I became the man I did. The horrors of my past have followed me my entire life, and all I did was pass them on to you. When I am dead, son, when I am buried in the ground, remember me for the man I was, and not the man you came to know. That man is your father. I know you have your own horrors from Vietnam, but you cannot let them haunt you. You cannot let them possess you, because if you let it, it will follow onto your children. Be a good man, son. If not for your own Christian soul, then for them. May they never have to witness the horrors that we had to. From your loving father, J.S.